Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, August 17th. I'm Ray Graff. Genealogist Tracy Scrabbett returns today to answer your questions about your family tree. Tracy is an archives technician focusing on genealogy at the National Archives at Boston. You have a question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Tracy Scrabbett, genealogy, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here to answer your genealogy questions today is Tracy Scrabbett. Tracy is an archives tech working at the National Archives at Boston. She holds a BA in art from the University of Hawaii, a master's in museum studies from the Johns Hopkins University, and a master of library science from Kent State with a specialty in archives and special collections librarianship. Just a note here, Tracy is not appearing on Vox Pop as a representative of the National Archives or speaking in any official capacity. She is here to help you solve some of the mysteries of your family tree or at least get you headed in the right direction. If you have a question for Tracy Scrabbett, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Tracy Scrabbett, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always happy to come in.
It is always great to have you here. And you make a long trek to come to this show, and we really appreciate it. I think the last time you were on, and I can't remember what month it was. You remember. You're smart about these things. We were talking about the rollout or the unleashing of the 50 census, and that is now done.
Everything is out. People can go online to our website and look up their relatives by enumeration districts. That's also made available on Ancestry and Family Search. And I know a lot of them are actually recruiting volunteers, people who are willing to help them index the records.
And what you did at you in your official capacity was what?
Well, when we received the scans from the Census Bureau, what we did is we worked with Amazon to have them upload the scans, and they did automatic character recognition.
Is it getting better? In the old days, it was terrible.
No, it's definitely getting better. I think the problem we really ran into with the scans is that the paper had deteriorated.
Yeah.
So you would run into something where the ink had bled, and so you couldn't tell the difference between an A, an E, or a C. And so the scanning would do the best that it could, but you'd have to go in and look at it and read and to figure out what the correct names were. And then also the database that we have set up had a particular design for how the boundaries of the enumeration districts needed to be set up. And so we had to go in and separate them with semicolons so that the code could read it to create the boundaries. So
is there any thought, and this would probably be impossible, but given that technology has improved, taking some of the old censuses that were done and rescan them and see if the data is, in other words, the very old ones, were they all done by hand by technicians?
No. So the problem with the older census records, and this is a problem with a lot of government records, is that in the 20s and 30s, when microfilm was becoming the modern technology, a lot of these agencies, and this is before the advent of the National Archives, which is in 1934, is they thought we can save space with this microfilm, right? So what they did is they microfilmed and then destroyed the records.
Oh.
So a lot of times, for example, if you go online and you're looking at an old census record and it's grainy or the picture's bad or whatever, there is no way to recover
that's terrible.
That. because, you know, at the time in the 1930s, they were using cutting edge technology, but it's still technology from almost a century ago. And so for a lot of those old records, census records, a lot of passenger lists, it's the same thing. The ports and the Census Bureau, they just microfilmed and then destroyed the originals because you could get, you know, thousands of pages onto one small microfilm reel. And, you know, so unfortunately, that's the issue with a lot of the old genealogy records, is that either it was microfilmed and then destroyed, so the microfilm now is the record, and that's the best that we can do because you can't improve the image quality on microfilm, or the records just don't exist anymore. This happens a lot with passenger lists, because before the 1930s, when NARA was created and they said, okay, these are the procedures for preserving government records, there were no real procedures in place. So a lot of times you would have passenger lists and they would sit in a warehouse at the port. And if there was a bad storm or someone didn't know what the records were, they needed the space, you know, records could be destroyed, records could be, you know, damaged. Records, you know, sometimes with the older customs records, you know, because we have a lot of people who look for crew lists and they want information about, you know, their relative who was a ship captain and what were they doing, you know, when would they come into port. With a lot of the older records, those records were considered the property of the collector of customs. So when he left, sometimes they left them at the port. Sometimes they kept them because they were considered their records. Sometimes they donated them to local colleges or local institutions. So sometimes it can be, you know, difficult to find out where the records are. For example, in New England, that's why Mystic Seaport has a lot of customs records, and the Salem Maritime Museum has a lot of U.S. customs records, because those came into their collections before there was a NARA. And, you know, anything pre-1934, we're not empowered to go to those agencies and say, you need to give us federal records.
That is so interesting. So you really, pre that date, you can't grab those records and say, we need this to fill in the blanks.
Yeah, we can request it. They don't have to agree. In the case of Salem, for example, they microfilmed all of those records, and then they were kind enough to give us a copy of all of the microfilms so that at least we have a reading copy of the information that they have.
What is the oldest census that is on microfilm?
That would probably be this. I think 1790 was the first census.
They were transferred in the 30s?
Yeah, they were transferred in the 30s, because we don't hold any census records. The Census Bureau holds all of the records until they choose to turn them over to us. So up until 1930, everything was on paper, and then they would, you know, they microfilmed it. 1940, they scanned all of the records. It was on paper, obviously, but they scanned everything and they sent us digital copies.
Right.
The same thing for the 1950 census. They scanned all of the records. What they did with them, I don't know.
Interesting.
But they're all scanned, and then they sent us digital copies of the records.
Tracy Scrabbett joins us today. Tracy is an archives technician working at the National Archives in Boston. We talk genealogy every so often with Tracy Scrabbett, and the number to call is 800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. Let's grab one before the first break, and then we'll hit the phones in earnest. Dawn is in Del Mar. Dawn, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have traced my grandfather, the town in Germany where he was born, where he came from. What I need, I found all the records in this country that I can find related to the family, but what I need is how to find a genealogist in Germany who can, because what I would like is, an actual copy of some kind of record. That's going to be my excuse for going to Germany, so I feel like I need that. And I have worked with this is on my father's side, but I have worked with a genealogist in Germany, but it was just by fluke that I found this person. So, well, he was actually not a professional. So I think I really need a professional, but I don't know how to find one.
Well, the first thing I would suggest is to look on Ancestry. They are digitizing a lot of European records, so it may turn, and that's from countries all over Europe and actually all over the world. So the first thing that I would do is I would search on a place like Ancestry. You need a subscription.
Yeah, I have done that actually, but I have found.
What you can do is any information you can't find, it's not about really finding the information. It's about looking at the sources.
Oh.
So if there's a particular type of record that you're looking for, go into their catalog, see if they have, even if the record doesn't have the information you're looking for, in the search bar or down in the catalog entry, they will list what their sources are. Right. So it'll say, what archive did we get the records from? You know, who holds these originals? And then what I would do is I would find the contact information for those.
Oh, yeah.
In the same way that if you weren't sure where to find something, you could email us here. Not here. We're in Albany. But you could email the National Archive and say, hey, I'm looking for X record. Do you have it? We would say yes or no, we have it. If we don't have it, we will try to locate the right archive for you.
But not in European, just in the U.S. for you guys, right?
But it would be the same thing. You know, archivists kind of all work the same way. If we have the information, we want to give it to you. If we don't, 9 times out of 10, we know who does. And then we can say to you, we don't have these records here. It would be at this archive. So that would be something to do. Would be to look for individual archives, because most of the time...
Although I think I've done that because... So what I'm finding is in Germany, the records are not kept in, let's say, the town where he was from. So it's a different part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem for me is the language. That's why I thought working with a genealogist there, he would be able to do, or she would be able to do the legwork.
Yeah, but the archives may have a list. I mean, we have a list on our website of non-affiliated. Of researchers and genealogists on the NARA website. They don't work for NARA. They're not affiliated with us, but they've worked with our records.
And that's NARA.gov?
Yeah,
it's on NARA.gov.
Okay.
And there's actually a list under Research Our Records. And then there's a list of like unaffiliated, but people who are familiar with NARA records. So something like that may exist at other... because what happens with that list is that the genealogists submit their own name, or the researchers, they submit their name and the information that they're good at finding, whatever their specialties are, and it's just a list that we make available, so other archives may do that as well.
Tracy Scrabbit joins us today. It's Genealogy on Vox Pop, and we are just getting started. 800-348-2551 is the number. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Tracy Scrabbit joins us today. Tracy is an archives technician working at the National Archives at Boston. You have a BA in art. You are an artistic type. And yet, you have this sort of detective bent where you really... You dig to find answers. Do you find that one half of the brain is... art is one side of the brain, they say, and then numbers and math and logic is sort of on the other side. Do you ever feel like, am I doing the right thing?
Not really. I mean, to me, it's not really all that different,
You love a mystery, though, right? You love to dig?
Yeah. I mean, I love finding the answers, but, in addition to being... a sculptor, I also trained in art history, and it's the same thing. It's detective work. It's figuring out, you know, the why or the where or the how of this artwork, you know. And so I think it's about a lot of art history, and even a lot of, you know, a lot of creating art is about being able or being engaged in putting pieces of the puzzle together. You know, you make one part, like as a sculptor, I'm like, okay, this is the main thing I'm making. What can I use to supplement that? What location should it be in? How is the person going to view it? I mean, it's all about, you know, creating a picture of this singular item. And it's very similar to what you do in archives or in history. It's looking at a single item and then placing it in its proper context.
That's so interesting. When did you realize in your life that this would be a path you would go down?
You mean working as an archivist?
Yeah, librarian work and archivists and stuff like that.
Well, I graduated from Johns Hopkins, and this was in, I want to say, like 2013, and there was no work in the field.
Yeah.
There was no work in the field, and the things that I was interested in, museum ethics, accessibility, material culture, those were not what people were, you know, were...
Couldn't make a living.
They were not hiring for that. And I recall going to the University of Westminster during my time. We did an on-site seminar, and I met with the archivists. And, you know, that one of the archivists said, you know, archives are not proof. They're only evidence. You know, it's not an archivist's job to tell a story. It's an archivist's job to preserve materials so that people can use those materials to tell a story. So, you know, you could say to me, Ray, you could come in and say, hey, you know, do you have anything that tells me what Alexander Hamilton thought about slavery? Because Hamilton was the collector of customs during a time when they were very rigorous about enforcing the laws on slavery. And I would have to tell you, no, I can't. I cannot read something and evaluate the meaning behind what is written. I could certainly identify every letter that happens to mention slavery that I might have and give that to you, but it's up to you to tell the story.
Very interesting. So. Our guest today is Tracy Scrabbitt. The number is 800-348-2551, and we'll get back to the phones in a minute. An email came in from Jackie in Queensbury, who writes, I learned that some U.S. military records were destroyed in a fire, my father's included. Do you know any, know of any efforts to rebuild those records?
Yeah, so most of the records, these were the full service records. They were U.S. Army records, and they were destroyed in a fire, I think, in the late 70s. Basically, the archival team went in, recovered everything that they could, and then what they've tried to piece together now are to at least get it to the point where it would be the equivalent of a DD-214. So a DD-214 is a certificate of discharge that you get when you you leave. And it's a very sort of like bullet point of what you did. Like, you served in this regiment. You went here. You served in that regiment. You were discharged on this day. It's just really just the bullet points. It doesn't really talk about anything that you were engaged in the way another service record would. So they have at least tried to rebuild that. What I sometimes tell people is to check. I know at least in Massachusetts, the National Guard, the Adjutant General, he had a great wheeze back in the 50s and 60s. He did. He wanted to create a collection of DD-214s for every branch of service for the state of Massachusetts. It didn't have to be the National Guard. So he started offering people, and he worked this out with the armed forces too. And they said, okay, from this day on, every time someone's discharged, we will send you a copy, and then we'll keep a copy as well. But prior to that, what he ended up doing is he ended up giving people a bonus. Like, he would pay them to bring in a copy of their DD-214. So what I always tell people is check your National Guard in your state. They may have done something similar. But also check the local VAs in your area, because they may at least be able to get you the DD-214 if the full service record has been destroyed.
That makes perfect sense. Tracy Scrabbitt is our guest today. It's Genealogy on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. We go to Round Top, New York. Gabby, you're on.
Yes, hi. Hi. First of all, fellow Johns Hopkins graduate program alum for museum studies. Class of 2017. I was wondering, along the lines of ethics, is similar to how, like, there's a controversy around who should house the Elgin marbles and different items, should they go back to their initial country? Is there anything similar to that with record keeping and with archive documentation? Are there any type of scandals or controversies of who should be holding and hosting documentation of different events?
Not in recent memory. I mean, I know that back in World War II, depending on who was capturing what area, there were a couple of different countries who had captured German records. Like, we have a whole bunch of them. And so afterwards, there was some talk about, you know, okay, for example, we have a series of records that are indexes of stolen art. And so there was some discussion, okay, do we return these records to somewhere in Germany? Is there another country to whom those records belong? So there is that. But I think we have escaped that in a way because we are just a business archive. We are, we don't keep personal manuscripts. You know, those are not considered government records. We simply keep the business records of the government. But the focus has always been on transparency. So I know, there was some controversy over some, the National Archives Museum, some exhibits that they did about women's marches. There were some political things that were blurred out, not because we were trying to, they were trying to make it unpolitical.
Yeah.
You know, and it ended up backfiring. I mean, it was not, and so that, I think, taught a good lesson about sort of not censoring records, which is not something that we do at the National Archives anyway. But I think it was at least this was the museum down in D.C. And so, but a lot of times we are excluded from that because, the records that we have are they're really business records.
Yeah. Gabby.
Yes.
Did you want to follow up?
No, I think that's really helpful. Thanks so much.
Thank you for calling. The number here is 800-348-2551. You got a question about your family tree. Tracy Scrabbit is here, and she arrives on this program every, 6 months or so, or a little like that, and it's great to have her come all the way from Boston to help us out on the program. Nancy in Rhinebeck. Nancy, you're on. Hello, Nancy.
Hello?
Hello. Okay. Are you on speakerphone?
Yes.
You sound like you're talking through a tin can and a string. Is there any chance we could get off a speakerphone?
Yes. You want me to speak on the radio?
You're on the radio now, by golly.
Okay. What I'm wondering about is what's at your guest, which I'm finding very interesting, what her opinion is of Henry Louis Gates' program, Finding Your Roots, which I often watch on Tuesday nights on PBS. They seem to use very sophisticated equipment.
Well, I think, on the one hand, it's a fantastic program because I think that, being able to help people find their heritage and find out more about themselves is absolutely brilliant. I watch that show. I watch Who Do You Think You Are, the BBC version. I think that the only downside that I can find, and I think a lot of people who do genealogy would agree with me, is that they make it seem a lot simpler.
A lot simpler.
Yeah, like you would think watching that show that you walk into an archive and people have a dossier that has all of your information, everything,
right.
And you can just open up a book. And they don't really showcase how many different places. Like, even if you're doing like a simple genealogy, okay, you want a passenger list, that's the National Archive. You want a birth record, that could be a state archive, that could be the Registry of Vital Records. You know, you want name change information, now you got to go to a probate court. You know, all of these records that, you know, all you really see at the end is the end result of probably months and months and months of work, because we even get requests from shows like Finding Your Roots, where people are trying to do, they're doing the research. So I think they're, it's wonderful because it can introduce you to different avenues of thought about who your ancestors were or the circumstances in which they lived. It can introduce you to different archives that you may have never heard of. But I think you always need to remember that there's a lot of legwork that goes into getting those answers in the end. But it, I think the shows are fabulous, and I find them really engaging.
Nancy, thank you very much for the call. We're joined today by Tracy Scrabbit. Tracy is an archives technician working at the National Archives in Boston. We do a genealogy show every once in a while, and today is that day. I have not heard of either of those two TV shows, by the way. You have to consolidate all the work in order to make a one-hour show, I would assume.
Yeah.
But there's so much. What is a mystery that you have tried to solve that still eludes you, the answers to which elude you?
Well, anything that has to do with my own family history, I think that it's always something that's really difficult for people of color, whether they be Native American, whether they be, you know, African American, or I'm Caribbean American. It's the idea that for a great majority of the people of color, there are no good records for us. You know, like, it's very rare, for example, for an African American person in this country, it's very rare for them to find records before the end of the Civil War.
Yeah.
Because before that time, you know, all you had were slave schedules, and the slave schedules would say, you know, this is John Smith. He has 5 male slaves. He has 2 female slaves. He has 6 children. They have no names. They might have ages. So it can be really difficult because, you know, when you come from, you know, whether it's like, you know, you have slavery here, I come from half of my heritage is slaves. The other half is Indian indentured servants because I'm from Guyana. There, you know, the records are not kept. The records are, the people are not listed by name, you know, and so that can be sometimes really difficult when you try to find people who are from those groups, but also to try to, you know, one of the things, this is actually something I read about. This was all Who Do You Think You Are?
Uh-huh.
They were doing Blair Underwood, and it was really exciting. He tracked his relatives back to Virginia, and what he found is that one of his ancestors was a free black man of color who owned slaves. And what I thought was really interesting is this was fantastic, okay? So there was a law at that time that after a certain date, if you were free, you were allowed to stay in the country, in the state. But if you were freed after this date, I think it was early part of the 1800s, you had to leave. You had 6 months, you had to get out of the state.
Wow.
So what would happen is free people, they would buy their family members so that on the books, the family members were still listed as slaves, so they did not have to leave the state.
Oh.
But they were now living with family, and they were essentially families that were reunited. And so I thought that that was just, because I'd never heard of that before, that that was one way that, you know, free people of color were able to sort of, in essence, save their families who had been separated, because all they cared about was you come to the census. Because the in Underwood's case, he had two slaves. One was 45 and one was 48. So and then 3 years later, the one who had been 45 was alive. So they're assuming that he probably bought his parents so that he could bring them home.
So interesting. But digging at that level, you're essentially then at one point you are off the grid as far as national records go or even state records. How do you we got to take a break here, but how do you continue that search after governmental records are not the thing to answer your question?
A lot of times you'll end up going to parish records, church records, because even if the government wasn't tracking you, a lot of people still went to church. You had to, especially with African Americans, many of them were forced to become Christians and they were forced to register. You know, it was a way of removing their, you know, their identity. And so, you know, I remember when I was a kid and we would move parishes, my parents and I and my sister, we had to get registered in the new parish. So a lot of times you can look at parish records or, you know, church records, depending on, you know, if you're a Catholic or you're Episcopal. I mean, synagogues have records as well. Mosques have records. Like, most of them will keep records of the people, you know, Quakers.
All right, hold that thought. I want to just follow up real briefly, and then we'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have a question for Tracy Scrabbitt. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get back to both the email bag and the phone calls in a minute. Tracy Scrabbitt is with us. Getting back to your point about parish records and temple records and mosque records, two questions. One, I assume that these religious entities are under no obligation to give those records up. And two, are the commercial entities that are providing information on genealogy? You mentioned Ancestry, and I don't even know if that's a paid service or not. Are they trying to grab all that information as well so people have everything in one place?
Yeah. I mean, that's really the point of companies like Ancestry or Family Search, is they're trying to make it easier for people to find information, to sort of remove the financial disparity that comes with working with original records. Because, like, for example, if someone says to me, oh, I want a copy of my my great-grandfather's Civil War records, well, you know, before, I would say maybe 10, 15 years ago, you either had to write to Washington, D.C. and pay for them to send you a copy, or you had to be able to get down to D.C. to look at the records. You know, there's a lot of difficulty with researching original records because you have to move or you have to pay for the records to come to you.
Right.
And so places like Ancestry, you know, Ancestry is the largest one, but you can go on there and you can find records from almost every country in Europe.
That's amazing.
You don't have to go there, you know. And the records may be, you know, the records may be in another language, but that's what Google is for. Okay. I tell you, I bought this package of food, and everything was in Chinese. And my husband's Chinese reading skill is not that fantastic. So I put it in Google, and Google translated it overlaid a translation of all of the directions for me. So a lot of people use that. You can get a copy of a record that is in another country, in another language, put it through Google Translate. I think it's called Google Lens, actually.
Yeah.
Where you take a picture of it and it will translate
Amazing.
It for you.
That's incredible. Yeah. Tracy Scrabbitt joins us today. One email here and then we'll hit the phones. Karen in Albany will be next. Linda writes, I'm trying to find out information about my great-grandparents' deaths. One died in 1918 in Connecticut. One died in Albany in 1887. I'd like details about the cause of death, if possible. I would also like information on my grandmother's birth in Albany in 1885. Is it better to contact the State Archives or the National Archives for this information? And that's from Linda.
State Archives all the way.
Yeah.
All vital records, birth, death, marriage, probate, adoption records, name change records, as long as they were not part of the naturalization process. All vital records are state records. They are not federal records. A federal archive is not going to house those.
Now, I think some states, and I'm not sure, I have no real direct knowledge of adoption records in New York, but I thought they were closed.
I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with New York, but in Massachusetts, it depends on the adoption.
Ah.
And the probate court will tell you that if it's still at the probate court or the judicial archive. Almost every state, I'm familiar with New Jersey, with New England, but they're all called some kind of judicial record center, judicial archive.
Yeah.
They would hold the state level records. So I always tell people, contact the state archives first, like for adoption stuff. They'll be able to tell you if they have the records. They'll be able to point you to the right court. And then the court will be able to tell you if those records are considered sealed, in which case you cannot access them, sometimes forever, sometimes for a certain period of time. It depends on the court and the case. But it's always best to start with the archive to ask them.
Tracy Scrabbit is our guest today. Genealogy on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the number. Karen is... Oh, that's a bad, loud start there. Karen in Albany, you're on. Oh, maybe.
Well, it's interesting because I am an adopted person, and our birth certificates were, as per Cuomo, he worked on getting them unsealed for us, which was really neat. However, I was wondering if you had any suggestions on other places, because I know there's multiple places birth records are kept besides just the state. Like I heard county courthouses, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the state and the time period, right? So,
gotcha.
For example, in Massachusetts, registries, you know, the records will be kept at the courthouse or the city hall.
County courthouse?
Yep.
Okay.
And then at a certain time, they'll say, okay, we've had this record for 50 years. The rules say now we turn it over to the, you know, to the judicial archive, right? So if you registered with the Registry of Vital Records, anything before 1925, again, this is Massachusetts, all of that was sent to the state archive. Anything after is still at the registry. So it really depends on the record-keeping rules for the state that you're looking for. Because there are even some records.
So that's what I have to find out.
Yeah, so the best thing to do, if you know the specific town, is to call the clerk and ask them, okay, I'm looking for these type of records from this time period. Do you still have these records? If you don't, who have you given the records to? But you can also do the same. You can do the same with the archive. Like, so you could call, like, say you were looking for a New York record, call the New York State Archives, which is where? Here in Albany. Shout out Albany.
All right.
You could call them and say, hey, this is the... These are the records. This is the time period. Where is the repository that still has these records? And they'll let you know so that you can cut down on the having to call 10 different places.
Right. But you still may have to call 10 different places. Karen, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Pat in Voorheesville. Pat, you're on.
Oh, hi. I had a question about a land grant.
Mm-hmm.
I found this. It's an original. It's a land grant, and it will describe things like this 100 acres goes from this side of the river down 50 miles down here. And what I want to know is, would the state of Tennessee have a map of this land grant?
They might, but it also depends on what the land grant was given why it was given. For example,
well, I was going to say my ancestor was a Hessian soldier, and he was captured, and of course then he fought for Washington, and he was given a land grant of 100 acres.
Yeah.
In North Carolina and Tennessee.
Yeah, so it could be.
Go
ahead, Tracy.
No, I was going to say, it could be in one of two places. If the land grant was given as sort of a pension, this is what they did. It was a pension after service in the Civil War or, you know, it could be that the maps might exist in other collections at the National Archives.
Ah.
So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it could be that, like, again, I don't work in Washington, which is where the records are, so I can't see them. So it may be that the full series is maybe a set of maps and then the land grants. Or they may Go ahead.
Somebody go ahead.
I was going to say it says from the state of Tennessee.
Yeah. Well, you could certainly contact them to see if they have that. You could also possibly, if you're trying to look for a map yourself, check a local library or a state library and see if they have any cartographic records that go back that far, and you can try to locate the area yourself. That might be a possibility as well.
Well, Pat, thank you very much for that one. And let's go to email here, and then we'll take another call or two or three. This one is from Michael. I have a mystery grandfather. His mother died before he knew her, and his father abandoned him at age 11. He was my favorite person in the world. I know next to nothing about him. He talked very little about his childhood, but I know he made his way from California to New York on his own. After that, I know a little bit. Where might I start to find out who he was and if he has family members who survive?
That is actually going to be quite difficult because you have to think about, you know, you think to yourself, Ray Graff, that's a pretty unusual name. I imagine you could probably find other Ray Graffs out there.
Oh, you sure can.
And that's a big problem with a lot of trying to find these mystery ancestors, is that we don't think about how common our names actually are.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it can be really difficult. So what I might try doing is try to remember, did he ever mention working anywhere? Did he ever mention where he may have lived? You know, could you possibly find him on a census record? Could you find him on multiple census records? And then you say, oh, in this year he was living with this people, and this year he's still living with the same people. You know, maybe he might be related to them. You know, did he talk about any travels that he made? Or, you know, in grandfather's time, great-grandfather's time, you know, traveling on the train was still a big thing. You know, does he talk about what route he might have taken? Are there still, you know, a lot of the defunct railroads, because railroads were a huge thing years ago, they will still have old maps. So if he says, oh, I came on this Northwestern rail, you know, well, you look at the map and you go, okay, these were all of the stops.
So that's a huge job. Oh, my gosh.
It is a huge job, but that's the problem with a lot of mystery people, is that if you don't have a lot to start with, it takes a lot to get to where you want to get to.
One of the shows we watch every season is The Curse of Oak Island. And I figured it out. Really, the search is the treasure. And I think that in this case, once you are really into it, that search has its own satisfaction, even if it takes you years to get to the end.
And that made me think. The other thing you could think about is you could also, I don't know if what their rules are on time period, but you could also do something like looking at his original Social Security application. When he filed for Social Security.
Good point.
Or when he, did he ever register for a Social Security card? You know, I remember doing that myself and having to put down my contact information and my date of birth. And, you know, so that's something else. You know, if he ever had any kind of government benefits, you may be able to research applications.
That's a clue. I love it. Let's go quickly. We only have a couple of minutes left with Tracy Scrabbit on this edition, but I'm going to book her again. And so we'll do it one more time at least. Robert and Phoenicia. Robert, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, guys. Great show, as always.
Thanks.
Two questions. A quick Chinese translation question. How do you put in Chinese characters into Google to get the translation?
You can actually take a picture of it. If you do it on, if you do it on your phone, or I think Translate also allows you to upload pictures. But that's what I find, is that you can, like I said, it's called Google Lens. And you can actually, if you, like, I just open up my photo app on my phone, and I have an Android phone, but it automatically asks me, do I want to view this in Google Lens? So that's
neato.
Yeah, that's how I do
it.
Robert, we only have a minute here. Yeah, go ahead.
Do these Ancestry, 23andMe, do they share information? Because if they all get it from public records, they should all pretty much have the same amount of information. And do they ever reach out to individuals to get information about their relatives?
Honestly, that I really don't know, because I don't work for any of those. I do know that federal records are shared between things like Ancestry and Family Search, because it depends on who has digitized the records for us, because we work with both of them. And so, you know, Family Search will digitize our records in Boston, and then Ancestry will get the scans from them, and you know, and vice versa. So, but as far as whether they reach out to people or how they do their research, I really can't say, because I don't work for those companies.
Well, Robert, thank you for the call. And Tracy Scrabbit, phenomenal having you back here at the studio. What do you think? We'll do it in 23 again? We'll do another one?
Yeah, sounds good.
Love it. Thank you so much for being here. Support comes from Berkshire Botanical Garden, Stockbridge, presenting Symbiosis, art exhibition, Music Monday concerts, Family Fridays, and 24 acres of ever-changing summer colors. BerkshireBotanical.org. Saratoga Jewish Cultural Festival, presenting Underneath the Lintel, August 28th, with two showings, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Skidmore College. SaratogaJewishCulturalFestival.org for details. At the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, providing more than 40 miles of trails for nature therapy and exploration beyond the shore of Lake George. HikeLakeGeorge.org. Once again, thanks to Tracy Scrabbit for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great emails, and we appreciate them all. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, and your phone calls were screened by Andrea Cunliffe today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's gardening. We'll see you at 2:00.